Flower Carpets. You're listening to the Oasis Podcast.
Welcome back to the Oasis Podcast, episode 24. We've been away for a little while, and I hope you guys all had a good break. I hope you did okay getting hold of Liam Gallagher tickets. I hope you did better than me anyway, because I didn't get anything, which was annoying. What a pain. What a horrible way of doing it. I don't know if anyone went through it, but we were given I'm going to start this episode off moaning, which is a good way to start. We were given a pre-sale. If you'd registered on liamgallagher.com, or if you'd bought the album, you were given a pre-sale code, and you could go in and on the Wednesday morning plug in this pre-sale code, and there was a bunch of tickets apparently available. But I tried and didn't get anything, and then and also people were saying there was all kinds of problems of, you know, the checking whether you're a robot and things like that, and just people having a nightmare trying to get through. And then I tried on the Friday morning when they went on general sale, couldn't get anything again. But this time they do that thing where you try and get them. I was looking at standing in Manchester at, I think, 52 quid a throw, which is pretty heavy, pretty strong figure anyway. But then when it says, no, sorry, all sold out, but you can have them through this site, and it's going to be like 85 quid a pop, or 90 or 100. And you just think, that's awful. I mean, there's one thing going off and finding one of these tout sites, but to actually just pop up straight away on the official Ticketmaster site, I just thought that was outrageous, really. But so yeah, so I'm without a ticket. I mean, maybe I'll blag my way in through the through a press pass or whatever, which I doubt actually, because although I've contacted Euroc, Liam's management, a few times, I've heard nothing back from them at all. So if anyone knows them or can get in touch with them, then please do. But I'm not holding out much hope. I think calling myself the Oasis Podcast is once again a reason for people from Oasis to not want to speak to me. But there you go. So I hope you guys have had a good few weeks. It's been nice to take a bit of a break from the podcast, but I'm really excited to be back into it now. We've got some great interviews lined up, to have some really good episodes between now and Christmas. Once again, a real mixture of people that were involved in the band, and I've got a couple of potential big names lined up. And then and people that were fans of the band and were inspired by the band, and journalists and writers and things. So we've got some really good stuff to come. Stick with us. And we've got a great interview today. Tom Hingley. So Tom Hingley, if you don't know, was the lead singer of the Inspiral Carpets all throughout their glory years, and sang on all their big hits like Saturn V and This Is How It Feels. And he is a really interesting bloke, very funny guy. I really enjoyed speaking to him. I didn't have to say hardly anything. He just was just a fantastic person to interview. So thank you so much, Tom, for your time. And I hope you really enjoy it. As we definitely do touch upon Oasis. We talk about the days with Noel, because, you know, as most people know, if you're an Oasis fan, Noel did try out to be the lead singer in the Inspiral Carpets, and he was turned down. And then a couple of months later, lo and behold, Tom auditioned and he gets the gig. So Yeah, so they turned down the fact to have Noel as their singer. But actually, as we talk about with Tom, you know, would it have worked with Noel? You know, Tom's voice and his personality and things just sort of gel perfectly with the Inspirals, and that's what made them, you know, a really great band in that period. So yeah, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Tom. And yeah, so our news catch up is quite a bit has gone on, obviously, in the last sort of few weeks. If you remember, my last episode, For What It's Worth, had just been released, and we were sort of having a bit of a chat about that. No new music from Liam, other than the fact that Bold was played in a radio interview. And so that's out there now. It's not officially been released, but it's obviously all over the internet. And once it's, you know, once the horse is bolted, it's hard to get it back. So let's have a listen to the album version of Bold. Yes, so interesting to think, hear what you guys thought of that, really. I was a little bit underwhelmed by it. I thought that the, having heard it in the Irish pub, it was one of our first episodes, actually, back in April, that had surfaced, and I'd played that on that episode. And then, and then heard him obviously doing it live at the various gigs. I was expecting a little bit more, and it basically followed the same thing, followed the same pattern, and I don't really think it goes anywhere. I have to see in the context of the album, maybe it sounds a bit better, but I don't know. I thought it was just a bit lackluster. And if you think about the four songs that have, you know, have been heard in full now from the studio stuff, Wall of Glass, Chinatown, For What It's Worth, and Bold, it's all fairly mid-tempo and quite, you know, Wall of Glass has got a bit of electric guitar to it, but he was talking about this is going to be such a punky album, we're going to be, you know, we're like the Sex Pistols, this band. Well, it hasn't been so far, really. You know, it's been three sort of fairly quiet mid-tempo tracks. So I mean, we know we've got stuff like Greedy Soul to come, which are much heavier, so we'll wait and see when the album's released next month. Yeah, not too far away now at all. And in Noel's world, it feels like the promotion for his album is finally kicking off. It's quite strange, really, that his album comes out only a couple of weeks after Liam's album. And I think it's rumoured to be coming out November the 9th. We know it's definitely coming out in November at some point. And yet, we've heard absolutely nothing from Noel. And we're hearing loads and loads and loads from Liam. But we did get what we believe will be the track listing. So the big difference between Noel's album and Liam's album is that Liam's obviously done stacks of promotion for months now, whereas Noel has done practically nothing. Even those big U2 gigs, he played nothing from the new album, and we haven't heard anything. I mean, it feels like they're starting to ramp things up now. His sort of social media channels have started to come back into force. So, you know, there should hopefully be new music coming out soon. At the time of recording this, it's Saturday afternoon, and he is playing later on today at the reopening of the Manchester Arena. And so, you know, maybe we'll hear some new music there. But but one thing that has leaked, and the original poster that leaked it was told to take it down, so I'm assuming that this is actually true, the track list for the new album. So the track lists are, apparently, Fort Knox, Holy Mountain, Keep On Reaching, It's a Beautiful World, She Taught Me How to Fly, Be Careful What You Wish For, Black and White Sunshine, Interlude Wednesday Part 1, If Love Is the Law, The Man Who Built the Moon, and End Credits Wednesday Part 2. So, yeah, feels like they sound like Noel titles. I mean, If Love Is the Law, well, that sounds a bit like a Seahorses song. And It's a Beautiful World, well, I've heard that a few times, but Keep On Reaching, you know, it's good old Noel. It's not going to... Yeah, they very much sound like Noel Gallagher titles, don't they? So we will wait. We will wait to see and hear from those. So that sounds great. Let's have a Hazed remix. Why not? So he's done a couple. If you go and check out Ross Hayes on his YouTube channel, Hazed, And this one I really liked. This is a Hazed remix of Bag It Up. So, you know, over here we like to play new music from bands. If you are in a band, and particularly like something that's particularly a band that's kind of in the Oasis wheelhouse of indie rock and roll Britpop style, then get in touch. If it's good, we'll play it. A band called Mischief Rebellion have been in touch. They were brought to my attention by a listener, Jacopo Lagomarsino, who sent in a little audio message a few weeks ago that was good. And so check these guys out. It's good stuff. I think it sounds like Oasis, The Rifles, definitely in that world. So let's check out one of their tracks.
Sister, are you wiping all your tears away? Oh no, so we left you. Would have now turned your world around, I'm sure. Oh, news travel fast around these parts, but I just need to say I can't believe in what I'm hearing, cause I always tend to disagree. Feel loose and fancy free, you know what I mean. Part of the furniture and I'm part of the scene. Why'd you act so innocent? We all know what you're like. It came as no surprise, I said it came as no surprise to me.
We've also got a competition, which is great. Now, I don't know if you've seen Vinyl Soul. If you go onto Twitter, they are at Vinyl Soul Images. They're run by a great guy called Matt. They're just celebrating their first birthday of Vinyl Soul. And what he does, he creates these artwork pieces of pop culture icons. So he's done Weller, he's done Oasis, he's done the Cortinas. He's got a special edition, sort of definitely maybe one coming out. And he's been in touch, and we're going to do a competition to win one of the Oasis Definitely Maybe covers. So stay in touch. Check out my Twitter for that. More details on there to follow. The other thing, so Liam's carried on doing promotion, and one of the things I really enjoyed was there's on BBC iPlayer at the moment, if you're in the UK, and I don't know if the rest of the world can get it. It's on YouTube anyway, but there's a series called BBC Backstage, and they followed Liam backstage at a French festival, and it's really entertaining. It's only 12 minutes long. It sort of follows a day in the life of Liam, sort of arriving and doing a gig and then leaving it, and it's very entertaining. So let's drop a little clip of that in here.
As far as I'm concerned, you can make the best record in the world, but if you look like a dickhead, you might as well stick that tune up your ass. You know what I mean? Whereas if you get a good balance of if you write good tunes and you look cool, then that's heaven. You know what I mean? So someone could come in here and go, ah, check this out, I wrote the best fucking song in the world. I don't give a fuck, mate. You've got fucking cowboy boots on. Get out. Do you know what I mean? Whereas if someone walks in dressed like me and writes half a decent tune, then we're away, aren't we? You know what I mean? So yeah, I think it goes hand in hand. Oh man, I don't mind, man. I can't wait till I'm about 80. I'm gonna start taking hardcore hallucinogenics. I'm gonna drink loads of fucking alcohol. I'm gonna get into fucking all sort, every drug on the planet, and then I'm just gonna fucking sit there in a waistcoat and in a pair of fucking like mad fucking trousers with a perm, a pair of cowboy boots on, and just fucking dribble myself to death. Not have to worry about fuck all. Fuck all fashion. Fuck tunes. Fuck football. Nish. Just fucking trip my bollocks off until I die. So I can't wait.
So let's crack on with this interview. So I hope you enjoy this. As I said earlier, this is Tom Hingley, lead singer of the Inspiral Carpets all throughout their glory years. and now doing his own stuff. Make sure you follow him. He is on Twitter at Tom Hingley Music, and all over the internet. If you just search Tom Hingley, you'll find him. And yeah, great singer, great musician, and an even better interviewee. So I hope you enjoy this interview. After this brief musical interlude, it's me with the great Tom Hingley. This bar of cigarettes, for which my heart will leap and it will lie. A debt to you, my friend, I owe, but I'm afraid I can't repay. Because I know Streetlight is my home, the place I like to roam. Going rose, I do my bones. Going rose, I do my bones.
You know what?
I did just
have controlled by someone on Twitter.
I did just see that on Twitter actually, that they that, yeah, it's just unbelievable that, that people just have the nerve to do that. I think they just assume that people aren't looking at Twitter. But you know, come on, it's that easy to just look at your own name.
Well, the thing is right, is that the person's like trolling me, but they don't use their own name. So what a boring life they must actually have if they have some kind of vicarious pleasure out. I mean, the fact of the matter is, he completely attacked all of my professional career under my own name, which is fine. As long as you use your own fucking name. It's bound to be someone out of some fucking band who was supposed to make it. He didn't, so I played on the bill. It's bound to be. It's always someone who's. I mean, don't get me wrong, I occasionally say things to get the eyes out. I've been slagging the royal family off all week on Facebook just to get people's backs up. So, I mean, I know I can't claim to be completely innocent of it myself, but I do it under my name.
Yeah, so
people don't agree with me, I'm going to get less gigs. I'm going to get shit at gigs. I don't call myself Winnie fucking Pooh, you know.
Yeah,
you know, I don't know.
There was a brilliant one. There was the boxer Curtis Woodhouse. He was a footballer for Sheffield United and he became a professional boxer. And they called him a troll hunter because he ended up... some guy was giving him a load of grief and pushed it a bit too far and started talking about his dad who had died or something. And then he just said, right, where does this guy live? And then a couple of people sent him a message. He said, right, that's only down the road from me. I'll see you in 20 minutes. So he's turned up.
Yeah, I've been asking this person. The guy said, he was slagging me off. I don't think he tagged me. So when I kind of bite back at it, he goes, oh, look, like you're really vain. I said, right. So, you're not even using your own fucking name. You're accusing me of being vain. How does that work? It's like, can be anything more vain than having such a sad fucking life that the only way you feel alive is if you name yourself after a letter of the alphabet, admittedly a capital letter of the alphabet, and then start lobbing fucking bricks at people who, you know, it's like, no, the guy was trying to be, he was trying to be a clever cunt, he didn't like it when I picked up on it, you know, no. I mean, like, he did basically attack all of my professional career. It's not really okay.
Not very
so,
nice.
Anyway, never mind. On to more positive clients. Don't worry about sad fuckers. I've been trolled for years. I've been trolled by loads of people.
Yeah, it's just.
I've been trolled by people I know.
It's just easier now, isn't it? The immediacy and the fact that you can just do it so easily and so quickly that. And it's. I tell you, something.
Well, if you've been an artist, you've kind of put your head above the parapet, so I suppose, in some ways, in some people's minds. You're in a situation where you should just be expected to take it. But I mean, I've kind of read stuff. It's just, I mean, like this guy was saying that I held and spirals back, you know. It's like Stephen, the singer who was in there before me, he left. They didn't have a singer for like 4 months.
Yeah.
Noel auditioned to sing in the band. I didn't get in. It's like, it's quite likely if a band started singing for that, and there wouldn't have been a fucking band to have been held back.
Exactly.
Anyway, are you recording now?
Why yeah, I am recording now, yeah.
You know, there's another thing, I saw someone say, we did like a chat with Marky Smith. You know, I want you. And I've read people on forums saying, oh yeah, I really like Mark singing, but Tom's somehow trying to get in with him, so he like he's singing in a particular way to sort of fit in with what he does, which is shit. And it's like, right, if it wasn't for me, that whole track wouldn't fucking exist. I sang the vocal first and then Mark sang it after me.
Yeah.
Like there was no, so if anyone was fitting with anyone, Mark was fitting in with my vocal. And what happened when we got in the studio was that we decided we wanted Mark to sing on the track, so we originally sang Saturn V. Let it take a ride on a zinc rocket. Jenny wants to be a rocket. So it was gonna be a Sputnik. Yeah. Reptile star. Saturn V. Yeah, so I was in the studio with Clint, so it was me suggesting that I Want You. So it hadn't been sad bastard Tom Hingley, who isn't as good on the single song, he's trying to copy Mark on it. He wouldn't actually fucking exist as a song. That bastard for the Curtis. Revisionism, you get revisionism. There was also another expert who went on about the fact that when we did our first album, Life, they were saying that Steve was in the band before we sang all the songs on it. There's 12 songs on that album. He sang on 3 of them, maybe. Before the album came out, and then you get these self-appointed experts who decide that they're going to rewrite history. And anyway, never mind. Let's carry on with the climbs. But you have to police it, because if you don't, actually, it sounds like something out of, you know, it sounds like some argument in early Islam or earlier Christianity. You know, when someone sets up the church, and suddenly you get into this tiny little, what seems to be like a little petty disagreement with so-called experts. You've always got some axe to grind. Yeah. But actually, if someone is rewriting what your contribution was to something that was a really big record, you do really have to say, no, actually, that's utter bollocks. It's not what happened. And you do actually have to say it, because if you don't, that becomes the truth.
Yeah, exactly. In the absence of anything else, then that does end up being the truth. But no, it's good, and I like it. I like the fact that you know, some people, you know, some artists will go on there and say, no, that's wrong, because you've got to call people out on their bullshit, haven't you, really? But
also, I think when I used to be in the band back in the day, back in the 80s and the early 90s, I was far too supine, I was far too accommodating, I was far too nice, and I'm not now. I won't let anyone take credit for anything anyone else did, and I'm sure as hell won't let anyone take any credit away from anything that I did.
Yeah.
And I didn't really act like a lead singer, really. I was a bit cowardly custard, and I'm not like that now. I would never be like that now. But I don't like bullies. I'm a bully, but I don't like bullies. You know, I wouldn't stand up for bullying for even a third of a second. You know, and there's that scene at the End of Stand By Me where River Phoenix pulls a gun on Kiefer Sutherland. Kiefer Sutherland says, "We're coming back to you." You know, it took me to the age of 47. Pull a gun on Kiefer Sutherland. It took me to the age of 47 to do something I should have done when I was 13. You know, but it doesn't matter when you get there, it just matters you get there. It doesn't matter when you get there, it just matters that you get there, doesn't it, Rune?
Carry on,
what do you want
to say? No, well, like that was interesting, and that was one of the questions I was going to ask you, because I didn't you know, so you grew up in, you know, this might surprise, unless you're, you know, an Inspirers fan, you followed it, you know, a lot of people listen to this, so, you know, will probably know, obviously most people know of the Inspirers from the big singles and from the big albums you did late, you know, in the 90s, but people might not know that you're actually from South Oxfordshire, a little town called Frawford.
It was all right, where they used to make MT sports cars, and there was a 1970s Wrigley Spearmint gum advert, which, there used to be an antiques sort of market in the town square, you know, where they sort of buns off the top, and there was a kind of quite iconic Wrigley Spearmint gum commercial that ran in the mid-70s, which was based in Abingdon, which no one remembers, but I suspect typed into YouTube Wrigley Spearmint gum 70s advert and you'll find pictures of Abingdon. And obviously they used to build MG sports cars at the end of the road where I went to school. So, I mean, it does have its share of iconic 60s and 70s moments of its own, which it could be proud of, I think. So that's where I grew up,
Yeah, but it's funny because I, you know, as we were saying before, I'm from Didcot, which is just sort of, you know, a few miles down the road. And it's funny, when you Google, you know, Didcot's been around, you know, since the railway came to it in the 1800s, but you Google, you know, famous people from Didcot, and it's nothing. There's literally no one has ever done anything of any note that's come from that town. And I think if you look it up on Wikipedia, it's sort of a guy called William Bradbury, who was the first person to widespread farming of watercress or something. You know, it's something crazy.
Jesus Christ.
And one of the theories I have about that is, if you grow up in like a nice rural town, especially somewhere that's got, like Didcot's got the train into London, train into Oxford, train into Reading, you haven't got that desire and drive that, you know, if you grow up dirt poor in Manchester or Oldham, like the other guys from the Inspirals did, or Burnage like the Oasis guys did, you know, you have to do something to, otherwise it's, you know, there's not many people are going to get out of that situation. Whereas actually, maybe if you're, the likelihood is you'll end up with a nice job as an accountant or as a, you know, whatever it is, you just haven't got that same drive.
Yeah, I think we were always, my dad was an academic and our families were kind of a typical, slightly bizarre Oxford academic family where, you know, lived in a big house, but camped in it, didn't have the right furniture for this big house and used to sit under blankets watching the telly, so it was a bit bizarre. Really kind of, we had a bit of a bizarre upbringing, bit of a Lawrence Dole upbringing in some ways, big family, I'm the youngest of seven. And so we were always quite creative. I think we were never going to be, like, both my dad's father and mum's father were preachers, if anything. Probably would be more likely to be a vicar or a preacher, and certainly singing and communicating with audiences, I think, comes from the family business, which is being nonconformist Methodist or Baptist preachers leading congregations. So I don't think the apple falls far from the tree, you know. So I was always going to do something creative. I mean, I was quite middle class and all that lot. But, you know, Clint's parents used to own a sweet shop in the 70s, you know, in Oldham. And you have to have stock to, to own a sweet shop. So if you own a sweet shop and you've got stock, someone's giving you credit. Not strictly working class, are you, really?
No,
you've got your own business and someone's affording you credit. You might be artisan class. Let's not get too obsessed with class, because people going about class tend to be, sadly, ones who don't actually possess any of it themselves. But I think if you're an artisan, you own your own business, you own stock. You're not strictly working class, I don't think. You're not Gallagher standards of things, you know. Yeah. But I think we were like I moved up to Manchester to do an English degree at the Met, and year below me had a guy out of New Fads in it, a guy who now is in the electric chair. So there were, and in fact a couple of New Fads were on the course a couple of years before me. And you know, and it's funny, that's the whole Manchester scene, because really a few of the charlatans aren't from Manchester. Half of New Order weren't from Manchester. I think it's always a bit of a, it's always going to be a little bit of a compromise when you describe a scene being from one place. Never quite as simple. And Martin actually is from Denton. He's not the original bass player. He's like the 11th bass player. But, you know, it's always a bit more when you get down amongst the get down in the undergrowth. It's always more complicated than it looks from the outside, I think. And you know, I mean, lucky I had a very fortunate upbringing. My dad was sort of academic. He was quite bonkers. I mean, he's dead now, but he used to write books in the daytime and sleep. He used to sleep during the daytime, then write books, you know, during the night. And he wasn't a spy, but he wasn't a million miles away from spying. I mean, he was an expert in kind of Russian and Soviet stuff.
Yeah.
And, to the point where he used to know a lot about the KGB and the precursors of KGB. It was called the NKVD, who sort of Lenin and Stalin set up, to the degree that Ian Fleming wrote to him in the 1950s, wanting some information about the NKVD and the KGB when he was writing From Russia With Love. Yeah, so my dad, he wasn't a spy, but he taught spies Russian. He had a spy school in London in the 1950s, where he taught British spies and American spies, French spies, to speak Russian. I mean, he wasn't a spy.
He wasn't a spy, but he was pretty close.
He lived across the road from them. Yeah, I mean, it was this really funny thing where Ricky Tomlinson, the guy used to present Countdown, having been a spy, to Richard Whiteley, you know. And they're on the press, "Oh, this is ridiculous." And his wife said, "Oh, it's ridiculous, yeah. Oh, the very idea of my husband being a spy." The sort of person who would have been a spy is the sort of person who wouldn't look like they would have been a spy.
Of course,
that's the whole point, isn't it? The whole point about spying is you'd actually walk around saying, "My name's Bond, James Bond." If you do, you'd get a bullet in there pretty quick. So I'm sure Richard Whiteley was a spy, because he's very good at boats. Very intelligent, and they farmed them all off and gave them all really good, well-paid jobs where they didn't really have to do any work, which I think presenting a TV program probably would fulfill that criteria. So my dad wasn't a spy, but he lived, you know, he was in the war before the end of the Second World. He was in Europe before the end of the Second World War. He told us a story that, you know, when they're in France after they'd got rid of the Germans, and there was a farmer who was he was conspirated with the Germans, and he was holed up in a farm. And they're only about 20 or 21, I think. Or maybe, yeah, 25, 26, just young men, really. And they told the farmer to come out of the farmhouse. And he refused, so my dad's mate shot him in the belly, and the farmer died. And this guy, he was only about 20, and he's bawling his eyes out because he'd shot this bloke dead. And it's not like your Quentin Tarantino films, your films with Roland Mitchell. You know, that's what war's actually like. And my dad said, you know, he should have put his arm around this 20-year-old lad who shot this French guy because they didn't have any choice. That's what you had to do. So you know, he wish he'd comforted him, you know, that, because that's what war's actually like. It's not romantic. It's not some bloody Greek heroic thing. It's a Greek tragedy. You know, so that was my dad. So my dad was quite creative. He liked books. My mum was quite musical. So it was a good background for getting into something academic. And I've always played in bands right from when I was like 11 years old. So, and then eventually I moved up to Manchester because I was the youngest of seven. And I wanted to get away from living in my mum and dad's house. And I had like the creative talent to write songs, play guitar and sing. So it was just quite a natural thing to graduate towards Manchester. And also at that time, it was a bit post-industrial, so there wasn't necessarily that much going on, which bizarrely enough actually makes it quite an attractive place to go to. Because you can spot the opportunities and probably make a difference, which you wouldn't be able to. If you went to London, you'd just be one out of 1,000 people trying to be Elvis Costello, you know. That won't get you very far, will it? So that's what happened, really.
And what about, I mean, because the Oxford music scene, kind of, I suppose you had kind of Tallulah Gosh sort of mid-80s, and then you had Ride come in late 80s, but did you kind of disappear up to Manchester kind of before that had sort of picked up, or was there much going on in Oxford?
Yeah, I went up there until 83. I mean, there had been new romantic bands. There was a band called Wow Federation. It was a very gay and sort of, well, and I think one of Brother Beyond was in then, but you're really talking post-punk. You're talking, there used to be a punk pub on the Cowley Road in Oxford called the Oranges and Lemons, where like the Ruts played and Joy Division played, and I could have gone to see Joy Division, but I stayed home and did my French homework. I was only about 12 years old, but you know, that'd been quite vibrant. And there was a band called Play Dead, who were from Wallingford, who were a bit of a heavy band who never really made it, but I think they're one of those bands who should have been big, but I think Class A Drugs got in the way. There's been a few of those, haven't there? I mean, like, Twisted Wheel should have been really big, but unfortunately, John, I mean, maybe, you know, I think he had some personal problems that maybe revolved around stuff like that. So there's been a few bands, haven't there? Like, The Lars, where they should have been much bigger than they were, but unfortunately, I think drugs, you know, drug problems were really important, even when the band held them back, I think. We definitely did with The Lars. The Lars should have been.
Yeah.
The Lars should have been, to be honest, doing this match. Don't want to offend your podcast, but it probably should have been bigger than Oasis, really. I mean, I'm sure that we met The Lars playing in Clinton. So Noel met The Lars because we did a gig in Valencia. They were on the bill with Happy Mondays. And I remember them singing Time, they got a song, Time's Melody. Singing that acoustically on two guitars in this little club in the middle of nowhere. And that's probably one of my top musical experiences of my life, you know, hearing that. And really, that was a career horribly stolen by drugs.
A melody called on wise me, a rhythm of life unties me, buzzing the sand of town away. If you look in your mind, do you know what you will find? Open your mind.
I interviewed this guy called Simon Mason. I don't know if you're part of a cross with him. He was the cat in that. He was known as the Cat in the Hat, and he was sort of a bit of a, basically a personal chemist to the stars throughout, like, and primarily to Oasis in the 90s. And he, you know, he sort of came out of it now, and he's now a bit more of a like a drugs counsellor almost, and has been doing a lot of work with people that have, you know, with musicians that suffered a lot of problems with drugs and have sort of come through it. And I mean, what he was saying, a similar thing like to happen to Lee Mavis, but to Mick Head from Shaq, that Shaq could have been really the biggest powerful. And best.
Yeah, he's very well, Pale Fountain.
Yeah.
Well, I don't generally talk badly to people, but we played, I think it was either V Festival or Tea in the Park, about 14 years ago, and maybe, and I remember Mr. Head coming into our dressing room thinking it was a toilet. wasn't. Maybe I shouldn't be talking ill of stars. That's what I probably wouldn't like. I mean, very talented, you know.
Yeah.
A nice bloke, but it wasn't a toilet. It was our dressing room. And I'm afraid it had to remain that. It wasn't. Couldn't be transmuted from one into the other. I'm
no. No, I was going to say the sort of going back to what we're saying about, you know, growing up in Oxfordshire and then going up there. I mean, you then, I mean, the last, you know, the you did the solo album Thames Valley Delta Blues, and it's sort of,
yeah.
So is that almost then sort of recapturing having been thought of as Manchester or being, you know, part of that scene?
Yeah,
for so
I
long?
Suppose I called it that because my mate Gordon, who's a guitarist in the band Too Much Texas, so I used to be in. We always used to make jokes about Thames Valley Delta Blues. I mean, there's a bit of a joke about it because a lot of guitarists out of the 60s bands like Jeff Beck and, you know, Jimmy Page were actually, and Eric Clapton were from in and around kind of London or the Thames Valley. So it's just a little joke that we used to have about the British police scene being related to a very undulatory Delta.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. Just a little joke in our heads, which was funny for us. It might not have been for other people. But it made us laugh for 40 years. So that can't be too bad. We used to think that you couldn't have gaffer tape, you know, the gaffer tape that bands used for tying up leads and stuff. We used to think you had to be in the Musicians Union to buy gaffer tape, or you couldn't just have access to it. But yeah, that's right. No, sorry, that's true. Probably doing a bit of reclaiming.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned about the, you know, like, well, when we first started talking about, like, you know, sort of finding kind of courage to stand up to people, even in the last sort of few years, and I mean, that's really does come across in the book. I mean, just to say, I haven't officially said, but you know, your book Carpet Burns is absolutely fantastic, and anyone that, you know, anyone that's interested in the sort of the music scene of the 80s, 90s up to now, it is, you know, and what I really like about it is that, you know, you can tell that you're an educated, in, you know, intelligent person. You write very well, and but then also, as well as that, what I really like about it is a lot of, you know, music biographies, they're just focusing on the creative all the time, and they never really go into the ins and outs of the money, the financials, the dealings, and that to me is the most interesting bit. You know, at what point, you know, the NME always, you know, whenever they're interviewing a new band, they're saying, oh, and this is their influences and this is this. They're not talking about, what, are they still living with their mum? Have they actually got are they doing this full time now? You know, and that was what I always found the interesting thing, that it was almost hidden. We don't want to talk about that, but...
It's a demystification exercise. I think that rock and roll is all a kind of dream. And I think the you know, it's like what hopefully originally punk was trying to strip away, was stripping away at the fantasy and stripping away at the, you know, I mean, there's this thing that everyone hates, you know, everyone who's into kind of indie bands hates One Direction because they mind to kind of backing tracks. There's two or three really quite famous rock and indie singers who are too incredible at the moment to mind backing tracks.
Yeah.
But the indie public out there slag off the One Directions and go on lauding these people. There's no difference between those two people.
Yeah.
And so you like music if you like it, or you don't like music if you don't like it. You can philosophize it, it's just the way it makes your bones vibrate and, you know, in your inner ear.
Mm.
So, like, really, it's all pop music, you know, like... Why we can style carpets, you know? Why were we successful? Why were we so successful in a way that most bands aren't? You know, there's luck, chance, breaks, hard work, everyone being quite different from one another, having a lot of different skills, and probably somewhere in there, at the age of being 24, I was probably quite handsome, and that probably contributed to it. But you're not supposed to talk about that because you're an indie band, and that only applies to pop bands. It's all fucking pop music. It's all pop music. Don't let anyone, you know, like. Tell anyone, mate, you think that Jesus and the Mary Chain didn't look good in those shades. They did. They might have been rejecting the more commercial mainstream kind of pop music, but it's still pop music, you know.
Yeah.
Whatever anyone says about it, it still encompasses rebellion and new ideas and rejecting the old. And a lot of indie music is about what it's not about. You know, it's what you decide that you're setting yourself against. And that's what you set your stall out. So it's all pop music, and I think people get. You know, I was talking to someone the other day, and I was trying to sell a CD, and they said, "Oh, you're a breadhead because you're trying to sell CDs." I said, "I bet you bought tickets for Stone Roses." "Yeah, yeah." "I bet you bought one for your wife, didn't you?" "Yeah, yeah." "How much did that cost you?" "Oh, it cost me £600." It's like, "Well, he's the mug there, then. He's the mug there." Because, like, a lot of these people who want those tickets. The Stone Roses is a great band, but some of these people who are buying the tickets out there are just buying tickets because of peer group pressure, just worried about what their fans will say if they don't buy tickets. You know what I'm saying? I'm being horrible here, but you got to not mug yourself. You can mug other people, but pop music is pop music. It's, do you know what I mean? It's all pop music. And the Stone Roses is just as much pop music as Brother Beyond or Wham or whatever. And I don't think that, I mean, it's classic pop music, it's ethereal pop music, it's better than anything we did, but it's still pop music. Oasis is pop music, you know, at its best. My favourite music by Oasis is when they were releasing 3-minute pop singles, you know, rebellious pop singles, punky pop singles, but it's pop, and that's good. I don't think you should ever bin pop. You know, I like pop music.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, that's cool. So, I mean, taking it back, so, I mean, the you know, this is the Oasis podcast, so let's at least talk about the fact that you, you know, it's a well-trodden story, but a lot of people that know the Inspiral Carpets and are big, it's, what's bizarre now is that like you mentioned in your book about, you know, reading a Trivial Pursuit question, which band, you know, which band did Noel Gallagher audition for? And so you are famously in history now forever, the man that was chosen ahead of Noel Gallagher. I mean, how is that?
Well, I wasn't in the band at that time. And I mean, in a way, that's a bit revisionist. Because I think the truth of it is that they auditioned Noel as one of three people. John Matthews, who ended up in The High, was another one. And the other one was a mate of Martin's, but I can't remember what his name was. But I don't think anyone would have been right for the band.
No.
And Noel didn't like Clint's lyrics to a song called Whiskey, and there's no way Clint's come out a singer who didn't like his lyrics in the band, and Clint's lyrics are very good, you know, but it wouldn't be right. But when there's a line which is, she gets prettier by the pines, and I don't think Noel liked that as a lyric. The thing is, I didn't know Noel had also auditioned to sing the band, because he didn't get in, and then 2 months later I turned up and auditioned, and I got in a couple of weeks, but they never told me, so it was like it was a secret that wasn't exposed to me until sort of 3.5 years later, when we kind of sacked him. So I wasn't party to that information that he'd actually ever auditioned to sing the band, because I don't think I would have been very happy having him as a roadie if I'd known that. But I don't think Clint would have been happy with the idea of having someone who'd been auditioned to be a keyboard player in the band being a roadie for 3 years. So there's you kind of wonder what was going on there. I think maybe at some point along the line we probably thought, should we have Noel as a singer, because it could be a bit more like Happy Mondays or something. We had like someone who, you know, Noel was never a scally. He was always very smart, very intelligent, very funny, very motivated in a great way, you know, and he went off and became a million times more successful than us, and that's fantastic. But, you know, they could have had him as a singer, but it would have been a more kind of scally band, which I don't think would have been good for the band, certainly.
No.
I mean, I suppose if Noel hadn't known the much greater success he got with Oasis, he wouldn't have known that. But I mean, it's a good thing for Noel he didn't do that either. So it wouldn't have been right for the band. I don't think the band would have scaled the heights that we did if I hadn't been in it.
Yeah.
And hey, look, Oasis is fantastic. But I think probably I've said this before, and I guess it was backed up, but I'm not sure Noel would have been famous if he hadn't worked for us, to be honest, because him working for us allowed him to not have, you know, he used to work for British Gas.
Mm.
Used to dig gas train mains, and Liam used to work doing that as well. And the pilot got chopped on his leg and he couldn't work, so he started working for us because he couldn't actually do his other job. And one of the things that gets people started in music isn't some big romantic thing, it's just the ability to actually not have to do a regular job, so provide him with income for sort of 3 years. So that's one thing. I think he also probably learned a lot about the business, because he used to let him attend meetings. And I think also he probably learned a lot about actually the music. So, on stage, watching us perform, watching what we played, and then decided to make sure he sure as hell never did any of that when he did his own music.
No. Well, you make the point in the book, it's like, if he had been doing that for any other band, it wouldn't have worked. You know, if he'd been roadieing for the Roses, he wouldn't have got on with them. If he'd roadied for the Mondays, it would, you know, it had to be that specific mixture of a band like the Inspiral Carpets, that it was just the right mix of people with his personality that he could see, okay, this is the way forward. And I think when you can see it, I mean, even in interviews, that like in that early kind of, you know, the very early interviews he does, he's coming across like he's sort of 18. He's not 18. He's like 26. You know, and
yeah.
And he's obviously been around you guys. And I mean, you said in there he would sit in on interviews and photo shoots occasionally, like if someone was ill or whatever. So he's done it. He's very astutely seen what you guys have done, and then kind of gone, right, well, this is how we need to
prepare. I think there's a combination of things. I think they didn't choose him to have the singer in the band. The band didn't tell me that they'd done that, because I wouldn't have been entirely happy having not working for 12 those years if I hadn't known that. So you have to wonder whether they were at some point planning to get rid of me and have him singing maybe instead or something. I don't know, because it's a bit weird when you get, because knowledge is power, and when you don't tell people stuff in bands, you know. And you do need tensions in bands to make them good. If you take all the tensions out of bands, you just bloody dire straits, don't you? Tension in bands to make stuff good. And he was canny. He was a great person to have around, a bit of a guru. I mean, we did find him very funny, and he always had good suggestions. But I think we just took him seriously, and I'm not sure that anyone up to that point had taken Noel seriously at any point in his life. I don't mean that in an insulting way. I mean, that is quite empowering, isn't it, if people treat you as an equal and having great success. But I think the other thing is that I mean, Noel's musical talent is all his own. I'm not blaming, you know, just talking about the mechanics of what got him to where he was. But I think the other thing was, I think we were a rather underrated band. I mean, I do gigs now, I do like the acoustic gigs, and I've got my own band, The Carpets, that play inspired stuff. But, you know, I've been playing guitar for 42 years, and I do these gigs, people come and say, oh, we never knew you play guitar. And I say, well, yeah, I've been playing for 42 years. So, like with bands, which are a bit underrated, there's probably a bit more to them.
Yeah.
DCI, whereas bands are overrated, rated, so we're a little bit less to them.
Yeah.
And DCI, you know, and there was one guy who was out of a fairly unsuccessful band when I did a gig about 10 years ago, and I said, you're quite talented, aren't you? And I thought, I'm damned by, you know, vague praise. It's like, well, you know, if we sold a million records, we probably were quite good. This is how it feels to be small. This is how it feels when your world means nothing at all. Black car drives through the town. Some guy from the top estate left a note for a local girl, and yet he had it all on a plate. So this is how it feels to be lonely. This is how it feels to be small. This is how it feels. You know, and then I read some on YouTube saying, oh yeah, these guys just got a record deal like overnight. No, we didn't. No one was interested in signing us. So we set up our own label.
Yeah.
We just toured out the back of a transit van like Rod Stewart had done 20 years before. And or 25 years before, and we just pulled ourselves up by our bootstraps. No one just handed us a record contract. Actually, we turned down the first three or four record contracts he got, because they were just major labels. He wanted the Stone Roses, he didn't have the Stone Roses. He would have signed us one record and then dropped us.
Mm.
So I think we're quite sus to that business. I think Noel learned a lot from that as well. But he did the opposite of what we did. We shared everything equally. He kept most of the money for himself. You know, so he kind of did the opposite of what we did. But to be honest, whatever you do, it's going to be wrong. It's all going to creatively come unstuck and untied eventually, whatever you do.
Mm.
You know. But, you know, it's just fantastic that he worked for us. It's like, I think we all be extremely proud of that he worked for us. And when Tom became a million times more successful, it's fantastic.
Yeah, and what about the what I always found interesting as well, because I suppose a little bit young for the Inspirers. I was sort of born 1980, so I remember like Saturn V being a massive hit, and I remember what I really liked about your book is that you mentioned the importance of the chart show, the Channel 4 Saturday morning show, the chart show. And because I've gone back and, you know, and it's quite good. People have uploaded sort of all the old indie charts and things from the, like, you know, from the mid-90s have all been uploaded to YouTube. So it's really good, like, going back and watching those. And you sort of realise the Inspirals are in and around the top 10, every single one. The indie charts.
That's why I think we actually made videos. And people liked us, but they liked us because they weren't getting what we did from the mainstream chart. They liked us because there's a terrific age difference in the group. And when I joined the band, Craig was 16 and Clint's 29. You know, there's an enormous age difference within the band. And really, if you look at your regular pop music, Clint was way too old to be in a pop band. But people like that, because people don't like being told. People don't like being told what they should like. They don't like it, do they? And I think, you know, if you, I think if we were around now with the internet and all that, well, I think we'd still be successful now, because I think we'd know how to harvest whatever is the mainstream media to our own benefits. I think we'd still be successful now, I think.
But what's like the weird thing for me, so is like when you think about, there's a lot of bands that we think of as, you know, inverted commas, Britpop bands, you know, that officially kind of came under that banner. And so, and a lot of them had quite a few records out a long time before it. Like Pulp had been around since the late 70s, and like Blur since, you know, first album 90, Charlatans the same thing, James the same thing, and yet they all sort of had their moment, their Britpop moment. And yet what I just couldn't understand, sort of, you know, sort of a bit revisionist looking back on it and then reading your book and just thinking about it, I'm like, yeah, you guys had massive hits with I Want You and Saturn V, and then your record deal comes to an end and you think, what is going on? Like, why didn't you guys get to ride that Britpop wave that
We always made the wrong decision about everything. I mean, like, the one thing that happened was that, you know, in the last 7 years, I fell out with the rest of the band in a way that's completely irrevocable, you know, and it's sad, and obviously we're not all still around, which is sad as well, but I think we were very creative, and maybe too creative, to be like a kind of five-headed hydra.
Yeah.
It was hard to actually pin us down and get us to do things that could be related to more mainstream business interests. And I think also we ended up, we binned our manager and we started managing ourselves, and there comes a point where you just go, you kind of go native and you're impossible to manage. And I think, you know, like a period of time we could have had a hit would have been after Urban Hymns, you know, when because of the Verve were around, then they split up, then they got back together, and they started to make that pop record, and going back to all that pop again. And there was a whole lecture I did when I was a lecturer about Bittersweet Symphony, about the fact that the Verve always maintained that they didn't know they'd have to pay all the money to the Rolling Stones, which is a bit odd considering it's actually included in the lyrics of the song.
Have to,
the record you ever made, yeah, it should do. Sorry, wrong with you. If you're done, you'd be head examining if it isn't.
that's just the mad thing. Another mad thing for me, sort of going back to like the way that your book does touch upon those sort of the practicalities and the real aspects of it, is the fact that, you know, mid-90s, having had all that crazy success, you're working in a call centre, you know, and I just think, what, you know, that's just mad. Imagine the sort of the people next to you at the call centre just sort of have to double take and go,
huh? No, I wasn't that famous. Some people in Manchester are quite down to earth.
Oh, okay.
The thing about it is that I'm not any better than anyone else, and I don't, you know, I always say to my wife, you know, I still have a very successful career now, you know, I'm doing smaller gigs and releasing records and writing books and doing interviews and stuff. But, you know, I always said to my wife, you know, that if she got ill or whatever, I'd go and drive a cab 50 hours a week. I've got no airs and graces, mate. Mm-hmm. Since I worked there and I didn't tell anyone, it was a bit like, don't tell anyone and don't deny it. So I suppose within a few days people knew that I'd been the singer out of this band, and then some people started accusing me of acting as if I had airs and graces, which I didn't sort. I think it's funny enough, if you've been a lead singer, it's quite a good education for working in a call centre, because you're quite good at being manipulative on the phone to people. There's some quite funny phone calls that happened there. There was one where a guy rang up and said that he'd ordered these rings, these gold rings, and hadn't got delivered. I looked on the account, and it happened about 30 times before. And so I said to him, "No, I've noticed that you work at a jeweller's yourself." I said, "Can you imagine if your company was ordering precious items and they weren't arriving?" And you were saying that they'd never been delivered. I wonder if your employer knows that you've ordered £3,000 worth of stuff from us that never got delivered. Phone straight down. Because, like, what are they going to do? Sack you from your £2.70 an hour job?
Yeah.
And brick it myself, you know. So, it did have its moments. And you have to, in my universe, everyone has to work. If you can't make money play music, then you have to shake something to make some money, don't you?
Yeah.
I wouldn't work there very long. I mean, the worst thing about working there at that job was that I just chain smoked all the way through it, which is not good. I don't smoke anymore.
No.
It's hard dealing with other people's bad temper, you know. I mean, it's pretty much like driving now. I don't know if I'm just getting middle-aged, but Jesus Christ. You can't be able to drive anywhere without instantly getting involved in road rage. I went out yesterday and I went to the gym. I got tailgated on the way to the gym. Came back, got tailgated on the way back. It can't just be me imagining it. People just need to be very in a very bad mood, I think, but at the moment. I think, I know I'm part of it, but just bad mood. You know, that's a bit like talking on the phone. Anyway, carry on.
That's fine. No, it's great. It's I mean, thinking back, I mean, one of the things, like, you know, that sort of transition from the crazy success you had. I mean, you mentioned before about the manager, Binsey, you know, that suddenly, you know, he was similar, like you're saying to your guy in the call centre, you're sort of having to become, you know, no one gets into rock and roll to be an accountant, right? You know, if you're going to be an accountant, you're going to be an accountant. And yet, if you're going to be a musician, you've got to take these... You've got to have an understanding of, you know, whether it's sales, selling yourself in an interview, whether it's, you know, accountancy, keeping your business, all these things that are not...
I don't think it was that organised. I think my first marriage was ending, and we just need to pay the mortgage, and, you know, I'm not going to go and just smoke weed for 3 years until you lose a house. You've got babies, you've got to secure your family, haven't you? It's just like anyone would do, you've got half a brain. You've just got to... You know, it was a bit perverse because I didn't want the band to end, so I felt like a bit like I'd been made redundant, you know, and that was difficult because but you know, that's all right. The rest of the band didn't want to continue, and that's okay, but it was a bit like we could have bought a big bus, a bit like the Levellers, and just gone around Europe for 2 or 3 years, and we made off £30 a year. But other people didn't want to do that, whereas I'm always perfectly happy to run away with the circus, you know. I think actually, if we had done that, we thought we would have picked up a record deal.
Yeah.
I think, but you know, they didn't want to do that. That's okay. There's no regrets about that now. It's what happened. It's historical fact. That's okay. But I think the situation I was in, I felt like I had to get a job just to pay the mortgage, because otherwise, you've got to. If you jump out of a plane, you're probably better off having a parachute, aren't you? Rather than chopping it off halfway down.
No, of course.
Yeah.
No, that's cool. And I mean, just sort of, obviously, the mad thing about the Inspirals is that so many of the kind of these legendary figures have sort of all surfaced around it, whether it's, you know, I mean, you mentioned, but we've mentioned earlier about Marky Smith playing with you.
And nobody said it was gonna be easy. No one ever said it was gonna be easy.
And that is a chapter of the book that is, you know, laugh out loud funny, like having the, you know, that little kind of window into this guy's life. And, you
know, that's right, how it is. I mean, I think Mark's a genius, but I think the journalists tend to sort of talk about the good stuff and not the bad stuff. Whereas I just talk about it very honestly. I just talk about how it happened. I don't gild the lily. I just say what happened. And I find persuading with someone like Mark, which is at some point, hopefully in the longest in future, you know, Mark won't be around anymore. And then BBC One and the Radio 4 programme will devote loads of time to talking about him, but they hate him now.
Yeah.
Because they don't talk about him now. You've got to remember people and worship people while they're around. It's no good retrospectively, you know, like when John Peel died. The nonsense that the BBC and like the Today programme spoke about him, and you know, like Radio 1 or had like a John Peel day. I can't imagine anything John Peel would have hated more than a John Peel day, you know. You know, and then, you know, you have these days, don't you, like Red Nose Day, which now goes on for 9 months. You know, like Red Nose Day can go on for 9 months, but call it Red Nose 9 months, call it Red Nose Day. Do you know what I'm saying? Am I just sounding cynical and middle-aged?
Yes, basically, but that's what we do. That's what we do here.
Yeah, but yeah, where all these, see, Comic Relief, where loads of massively well-paid comedians get paid loads of money for the BBC to pretend to do stuff for charity. It's just bonkers.
Well, that's the, I remember seeing, like, I think it was like when Cameron was still Prime Minister, and him sort of going on like doing some silly sketch and then sort of turning around saying, oh yeah, donate to children in need. And you go, well, hold on, why, children shouldn't be in need, and you're the person that can actually do something about it, you know. So
I was there by George Michael in Praying for Time, Alliance of Charities at Coates, you wear once a year. Charities at Coates, you wear once a year. That's a brilliant line. That's a line, you know. So, you know, you can't give at least a charities, but, you know, Red Nose 9 months. You know, call it Red Nose 9 months, but call it Red Nose Day, because it ain't a day anymore. John Peel Day, you know.
So, yeah.
You know, and then they wanted us to do a gig for Radio 1. It's like, right, okay, so we've got to get down to the Astoria. So are there any expenses? No. Right. So there's no expenses at all, right? So it's being presented by these two Radio 1 DJs. Are they getting paid? Yeah, of course they're getting paid. Yeah, of course they're getting paid. How does that work? Right. The people presenting it get paid full dibs, and you don't even get 50p for a pack of polos. You know, I love John Peel, and he's great, but the idea that there is some app you can download on your phone that will make you into John Peel. So all about John Peel, who told you should go your own way, not conform to someone else, you know.
Middle-aged wind. Well, I was going to say, like, the other thing, I mean, just having a look down what you're up to at the moment, it's crazy. You are so unbelievably busy. You know, I think you're up at the Beano at the Sea coming up next weekend, I think, that down at Hastings.
That's this weekend.
Oh, that's this weekend coming.
Yeah, we're doing the after show thing in the White Lion Theatre. After Blue Tones and Embrace and Space and all the other people playing. They've got a lot of really good bands on there.
Right.
And I've got two solo gigs. I've got a DVD coming out of me playing Spiral Carpet stuff with the band. And the DVD's coming out for Christmas. It's called May Contain Nuts. That's what the DVD's called. So that'll be in shops and on Amazon and the gigs. So, yeah, really busy, really. And writing another book next year, but I can't tell you what it's about. So tell you what it's about, then if I don't write it, I feel like Dracula or something. I feel like I've sold my soul as I tell him what it's about. It'll take 4 years to write, and they'll be like, we haven't finished that book yet, because it takes 4 years to write a book. So, you know, so I think next year more book. I'm writing a book, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, going all the way back to, like, you saying about your dad and, like, what he did, that's the thing, you talk quite a lot about your childhood in the book, and then you don't really mention it again other than, like, later on when they go and see you for the first time, which isn't until much later on, isn't it? Even when you've reformed, even, I think. I can't remember what it is, but you've... what did your parents think about, you know, as an academic, as the child of an academic, were you not... Did they sort of look down upon this?
I thought it was completely ridiculous, which is by far the healthiest attitude that any parents can have to a pop star. I think they thought it was completely ridiculous and it wouldn't last 2 minutes. I mean, I think my dad's attitude was exemplified by what he said at Reading Festival, because he went to Reading Festival, I got a card Yeah. I mean, it was a big compliment in a very dry and ironic way, which my dad was very good at being like, but it was a compliment, but embedded in a kind of, it's all completely ridiculous, don't believe in any of it really kind of way, which is a very healthy attitude to have towards the whole thing, I think.
And were they still waiting for you to get a proper job, or did they accept that, okay, no, this, you...
No, actually, when I went to go work in the call centre, I was working there for a year, my mum said, you need to get back to playing music, because it's what you're best at doing, which a lot of parents, I don't think, would ever say to their children, to be honest. Yeah. I thank her, she's not around anymore, but I thank her forever for saying that. But I was good at playing music, and to be honest, I can have a much better kind of life, quality life playing music than I can doing anything else.
Advice. Yeah, no, it's great. And it's great that there's still the... I mean, it's funny, like, having the interviews that I've done with the musicians, you know, like Steve White, who was, you know, from the Style Council and Weller's Band and things, and it's just like, you just need to be a bit cleverer. I think that's it. Like, there's still, you know, there's still a careers that can be made for people in music, but, like, Steve was, you know, does a lot of teaching, and he does a thing where, you know...
I think the guy's producing my next album. I've got an album coming out next year called I Love My Job, and the guy's producing is called Gary, and I think he's producing Steve's new album, actually.
Oh, is he? Oh, the Family Silver one?
Yeah. Small World.
Yeah. No, but it's just, I think it's sort of what keeps coming across now is that, okay, the money's not there that was there, like, in the 90s. You're not, you know, spending £30,000 on music videos, you know. You're not doing these, like, it's just not there anymore. But actually, there is still, you know, you can still make a living off it if you're just sensible and you kind of manage it in the, you know.
I think, unfortunately, I mean, all the rest of the world has got more like in the music business. I think if you work for McDonald's, you kind of don't know whether you're going to work one day or another, do you? Our contracts, unfortunately, kind of gig economy means that the whole of the world has got more like bloody musicians trying to get record deals. The whole of the world has got more like that. So actually, as there's less surety, there's less full-time employment, actually being a musician is no less, you're no less insecure being a musician than you are being an arc welder or a bank manager nowadays. It's a sign of the way the whole of the economy's gone, I think.
Yeah,
it was quite funny, you know. Sort of 10 years ago, Guy Hans bought EMI, you know, his private equity guy, because he wanted to break it up and sell it off. And it's hilarious, really, because it was almost like these hedge funds have been asset stripping companies. But it's a bit like someone had bought a blood bank and then found out after they bought it that it was already owned by Dracula. Because you'll never be able to, you know, those people in the music business are more cynical than any hedge funds. They now have assets strip any hedge funds within hours. And that was like the biggest corporate disaster of his life, because the music industry is very complicated, and anyone thinks they can walk in and just pull the meat off the bones and make money out of it, you're a fool if you think you can do that, because it's so complex. And hedge funds, you're daft if you think that there's an easy dollar to make out of doing that.
No, it's fine. And I mean, how are you finding it with? I know your stuff's all on Spotify, so you know your stuff with Inspire. Even Too Much Texas are on there, actually, and like. So everything's on there, and you do your physical, you know, selling CDs at gigs and things like that, and you're, as I say, you're so busy with gigs. I think you're saying you average about 150 gigs a year or something. So
probably a bit more than that, actually, for personal appearances. It's all right. I mean, it's been a bit of a weird thing, because I mean, obviously you can buy stuff in the shops as well. I have a physical distributor called SRD, so you can order it in the shops if you want, or buy it from Amazon. But I have this thing where every year about 800 people want to have their picture taken with me, which, you know, which is a bit odd, but, you know, there's been an occasion where, sadly, someone rather closely associated with me died, you know, and immediately after that, people want to have their picture taken with me, and I was like, I don't want to do a picture because they stick it up on Facebook, and there'll be me in some club in Burnley grilling my face off, and somebody doesn't know the context of this thing, I don't care about that, but close associates have just passed away, and no one understands that. It's like, it's a selfie is all about the person who wants to have it done. It's not about me.
Yeah.
You know, I don't mind doing them, but in the wake of someone I'm closely associated with, just having passed away, I don't really want to be grinning like a Cheshire cat.
No.
In a photograph with someone, and they don't get that really. And I think the selfish thing, it's a cultural thing that will probably last for 8 years, you know. When we look back at it in 15 years' time, people think it's crazy that we used to have pictures taken stood next to people. And I mean, I met Peter Capaldi in London on the Under Club about 4 months ago. I'm a massive Doctor Who fan, but I sure as hell didn't ask to have my pictures taken with him.
No.
So I don't do it with other people. I'm very happy to do it 99% of the time, just wasn't happy in the wake of, you know, someone dying, because it just didn't seem appropriate, really.
No, no, of course not.
You know, there's a couple of gigs coming up, actually. We're playing at the 9 Day Cafe with the Carpets on the 30th of November, which is kind of early Christmas gig, and we're playing at the Fiddler's Elbow in Camden on the 4th of November. Ooh. 4th of November, if anyone's around in London, so that should be a good gig.
No, that's great. No, that's brilliant. And you know, and as I say, I think the a big thing as well is, you know, you've got to get that book. Like, The Carpet Burns is just, you know, as a story of the Inspiral Carpets, it's interesting because, you know, you guys were just such a interesting mix of characters and kind of. But then, as I say, it's also the fact that you intersect with all these different things that were happening around that crazy time. And you guys were sort of right in the middle of the eye of the hurricane, really. I mean, looking back now, what's your kind of takeaway from, you know, from both the sort of the Manchester scene and also like what the madness of that happened with kind of Britpop as well, having kind of predated
it. Manchester was the biggest youth movement that happened since punk, and it was just very big, and it was rejecting Thatcher and rejecting probably made up pop bands from the south of England that no one was interested in, and it was positive affirmation of Manchester and its sort of sense of humour and its eclecticism that had come from the Hacienda and all the old 60s bands and the punk bands. And I suppose in the Britpop thing, it was an exciting time for music. It was throwing over what had come before, you know. And it's difficult now for something to have that power, because with the internet or Facebook, everyone gets the life sucked out of it before it's even arrived nowadays. So it's hard for something to have that kind of impact ever again, I think. You know, like maybe there's a big historical change coming, maybe it's Brexit or something else, maybe we're going to have a massive loss of power and standard of living, and then there'll be a reaction against that. That might create a new art movement, maybe, but it'd be hard for it to survive the first 72 hours of Facebook exposure, I think.
Yeah.
And WhatsApp, and you know, I think it's hard for things not to get destroyed by too much attention, I think, nowadays.
No, that's very true. And so, I mean, looking back at, you know, I mean, just touching on kind of the Oasis side of it again, this is the Oasis podcast, we better talk about them a little bit. I mean, what's the, did you sort of follow their career? I know you mentioned about the, that you did used to kind of be in the rehearsal room next door to them. And so you heard them kind of very early on, you know, rehearsing kind of the same three songs over and over again, effectively, kind of learning how to play their instruments. I mean, that's a pretty crazy thing to have been there.
Well, the only song that they could play, as far as I can remember, very early on, was One by U2. Stand 5 by Inspiral Carpets, which hadn't actually been released at that time. And a house record, which I still can't work out who it was, but it used to go, I wanted you to know,
Okay.
Yeah, I remember those were the only three songs that I could play when Noel originally joined them. I remember the first interview with him in The Word and the Evening News, and there was a picture of them in Castlefield. I remember my first wife looking at it, and we looked at the picture, and she said to me, they're going to be massive. She said, I saw him play in the boardwalk twice, and I saw them support Revenge at Middleton Hippodrome, which is on the night of that Freddie Mercury tribute, playing in front of about 70 people. But I can't tell you that I didn't understand it at all. I can't sit here saying, oh yeah, I could see. I can't say that I understood the music at all, because it was sort of revolutionary, it was different, and I didn't get it. And it wasn't until definitely maybe being recorded, and we sort of a full year later, or maybe 18 months later, we were driving around Eastern Europe with Moby, doing some little gigs for Mute Records, and Craig was playing me Definitely Maybe, and I wasn't not trying to listen to how good it was, and Craig was going, you need to listen to this, it's just amazing, it's really great. And of course he was absolutely right. He was right,
yeah.
He was dead right. But I mean, I don't really believe the story about Alan McGee signing the King Tuts, because there was a band who was signed to Creation. He used to rehearse in the boardwalk called Metal Arc 11.
Yeah.
And I think Alan McGee would have been going down to boardwalk probably for up to 18 months before he signed Oasis. And the very idea of getting within 100 yards of the boardwalk and not being able to hear them playing at 1,000 watts is extremely unlikely. And the only thing that was louder than the band would have been Nolan Leeds' personalities. Yeah. So there's actually no way that he wasn't aware of them, and I don't believe that story about King Tut's. I know that very early on Noel gave a demo to Johnny Marr, and Johnny Marr passed it on to his manager, Marcus Russell at Ignition, and they were talking about possibly Johnny Marr producing some stuff for him or something, or writing stuff with him or something. And that was before the Alan McGee thing. But you can't mythologise a rubbish band. You can't mythologise a band who are really great. And they, for me, I think their first album's astounding, and I think probably half of the second album is. But I've got to say, I'm afraid I don't like anything else really, to be honest. I like some of the stuff Noel's done. I like some of the stuff Liam's done, but I'm not really a fan of Oasis stuff after the first two albums, really, to be honest. But that's just me. Don't expect other people to agree with me. That's my. That would be my kind of. My kind of approach to it, I think. Yeah, the other thing I was going to say is Liam, people give Liam a hard time. I've only seen Noel and Liam probably once or twice each since they became megastars. Liam gets a hard time. People always sort of, the kind of access to his public image is actually really nice, I think. The few times I've met him, probably two or three times I've met him since he became one of the most famous people in Britain, he's a thoroughly nice bloke, kind of thing. Yeah. From my experience, he was very nice back in the day. I mean, he had like a smile college haircut for about a year and a half. I think he's a really nice bloke, actually.
Yeah. And what about the other guys? Did your part ever cross with, like, and you mentioned Bonehead, I think, from early days of sort of Oasis getting signed, that you being there?
Bonehead was kind of, they were a bit kind of trying to prove themselves, and obviously both Noel and Liam were a bit rude about us at the early days of Oasis, because they wanted to separate themselves completely from us, which is completely understandable. Yeah. But I mean, I did a gig, I played with Bonehead about 2 years ago, and it was his 50th birthday party, so I kind of played with him. But he's a really nice bloke, and a big part, I think, of the Oasis story, I think, both personally and musically, I think, probably. Yeah. I met the original drummer.
Tony McCarroll.
A few years back. He seemed like a nice bloke. I don't really like that much stuff that they did after he left him, really, to be honest. I can't explain why it is. I think there's something about the vocals and the guitar being really foregrounded, because maybe the other musicians are kind of following them, and I think that was when the band sounded their best, I think. Kind of classic lineup, early doors, I think, really.
Yeah.
That's the way I feel about it. There's nothing better than that, though, is it? The early stuff they did. For me, I'm not, I don't get into bands and just be into them forever because I like the first thing they did. You know, for me, I'd have to check out every album and decide. I like Band of Horses, and I really like the first three albums. I haven't really liked the last two albums, you know. I really like Arcade Fire, but haven't really liked all of the last two albums, you know.
Yeah.
I really like the first three albums or four albums I really liked, but I don't just like all of something because I like the first thing I heard, but I'm not a fanatic.
Well, I do wonder if there's been, like, a sort of meetings with very clever, statisticians saying, right, well, if we look at the Libertines, you know, they stayed apart for X years, so Oasis need to stay apart for 15 years.
It's massively influential to the managers, the Roses, and I'm sure he works very closely with Noel, so I think he just put £10 million into the Roses show and just go away for 7 years, don't you? So I'm sure they will be playing again. But in the words of one of their songs, they do need one another. Anyone who says that band is that band without either of the Z Brothers, it's really bonkers, because you need both of them in that band, don't you? There's no question about that. Yeah. And they know that too. I'm sure they do.
Absolutely. Great. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time, Tom. I do really appreciate it, mate. We'll speak to you soon.
Cheers, mate.
Bit of acquiesce, perfect way to end any interview. That was really good fun to talk to Tom, real privilege, what a top man. Covered so many different subjects, what a great turn of phrase he's got. If you want to hear more of his sort of wit, then get hold of that book, Carpet Burns. As I said, I'm going to put an Amazon link in the description of this podcast, so go and crack on and get hold of that. It's definitely worth a read. And and if you can get out and see him live, as he mentioned in the episode, he's playing London in November. So if you can make one of those dates, or if you just keep an eye on his website at Tom Hingley Music, and get out and see him, support live music. So a couple of other bits, bits of housekeeping around the podcast, as we normally do. Just having had a look on iTunes, we've got another review on the UK site, which was by Danny Kedwell. And he says, a must for anyone who still feels blessed to have been young in the 1990s, a window to a time when music felt exciting and you could discover new songs almost weekly. To quote an elder statesman, the kids know where it's at. So thank you very much, Danny, for that. So thank you for listening to the Oasis podcast, and special thanks to our patrons, Casey, David, Fraser, Mike and Dana. And to our new patron, Mark, who is also supporting at the $5 a month level. And I offered him a song and he said he didn't want one. He just was happy to support the podcast. So maybe that says something about the songs. I don't know. And speaking of the songs, we are due to do a couple of songs for people. But unfortunately, my colleague Joel, who helps me with those, has just had his iPad break, which was very upsetting. So there are songs coming, so just bear with us. You can become a patron and support the show at patreon.com/oasispod. If you head over there, that's where I post articles by myself and the contributors Richard and Kyle. I've just recently uploaded another article by Richard, which was really good, which was a review of Liam at Reading Festival. And I've got one to post by Kyle as well. So by the time you're hearing this, that may well be up there. That's a breakdown of all the various Oasis related places to go to in London. If you support the podcast at $3 per month or above, that qualifies you for your own bespoke song. Follow me on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook, just at Oasis Podcast. Email me at oasispod@gmail.com. There are t-shirts available at TeePublic. And please, the best way to get in touch is to subscribe and review us on iTunes. So as ever, stay in touch, stay engaged, stay young.